Welcome back. As we continue our march through Genesis, we're going to continue to look at how human civilization developed, how humanity responded to God's good covenant, how God intervened in the midst of human depravity. We're going to spend some significant time addressing those issues, and as we do, as always, I would encourage you to ask, how does this reveal the Lord Jesus Christ? What is happening in the narratives that we are reading that anticipates the coming Messiah? Let's pick up where we left off in Genesis chapter 9. Well, last week we left off at the Noahic covenant in Genesis chapter 9, verse 9. It says, "Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you." And of course, the sign of the covenant was a rainbow, and that was described in the 13th verse. And so every time that we look up after a rain, we see a rainbow in the sky, we are reminded of God's covenant with humanity, that he will not destroy the earth again by flood. This is a measure of God's graciousness and mercy. It is not that humanity doesn't deserve to be destroyed. Think about the headlines that we have seen just over the last few days, and all of the wars and rumors of wars, and all of the human depravity, as well as suffering that is caused by other people. So we see all of these consequences, and we have to ask, are we less depraved than those who were flooded in Noah's day? Well, I doubt it. I think the reality is that God in his mercy has withheld his wrath, has withheld his righteous judgment. And so we should be grateful. We should worship God. We should return thanks to him for that. But it's going to be very interesting as we read through Genesis, especially over the next few chapters, we're going to find that rather than return thanks to God, rather than sacrificially living for him, we're going to find that humanity doubles down again on its wickedness. And by the way, if you're already kind of weary from hearing about people embracing sin as opposed to the righteousness of God, we have a lot of reading ahead, a lot of human history. That says a lot, doesn't it? Well, we continue. It says, "And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard." Now again, the 19th verse there, it says that from these the whole earth was populated. That obviously eliminates other options such as a regional flood, which some people contend for. That is not categorically available to us. Instead, we know that the entirety of the population of the earth was destroyed except for those who were in the ark, who are now emerging from it. It described Noah as one who planted a vineyard. And then in the 21st verse, it says, "He drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him." Now, there's a lot of speculation about exactly what took place in his tent. Who was to blame for these actions? Was Noah getting drunk? Was that an accident? What were the consequences? Was he exploited? Was there some other aggressive act that was horrific and sinful? Well, what we do know, and not going beyond the text, is that regardless of all of the details that transpired there, the reality is that Noah was exploited. He was mocked in his nakedness. And here, there was an opportunity for him to respond and cover his father's nakedness, to cover his guilt and shame, as God had done for Adam and Eve in the garden as he clothed them, even though they had sinned. But rather than doing that, he makes some sort of a measure of a mockery against his father. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and walked backwards. They covered his nakedness. This is really a powerful picture of ministry, isn't it? When people are covered in guilt or shame, they have been harmed by the sin of other people. Again, we don't know all of the details here that transpired and whether Noah intentionally was drunk or not. Again, people speculate both ways. But regardless, there's a ministry opportunity to come and clothe somebody, to get rid of their guilt and shame, to encourage them in what they have in God, to reaffirm them as valuable people made in the image of God Almighty. Noah awoke from his wine. He knew what his youngest son had done to him, so he's angry, he's grieved, and we're going to find a curse and a blessing that is pronounced. And again, we're dealing with humanity. We're looking at these early generations. And so the consequences of these blessings and these curses are going to be very significant. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brothers." Now, this is really interesting. Was it Canaan who saw Noah naked? No, it was Ham. It was Canaan's father. But Canaan is cursed. It says, "He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." Noah lived 350 years after the flood, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Now, there's some interesting things that are revealed here. First, we find that Canaan is the one who is cursed, not Ham. Now, Ham is going to be the ancestor of all of the people south of Israel. And so you could imagine the Egyptians, people such as that in Africa, the Canaanites in Israel, and that the Promised Land area would be included therein. And so there have been some in the past from a racist projection who have tried to make this argument that somehow there was some sort of a curse that was put on all people of color. This, of course, is not what happens. And I think it's really interesting that God clarifies exactly who is cursed here. He doesn't curse Ham and all of his descendants. Instead, he curses Canaan. And the Canaanites are going to become an exceedingly wicked people upon whom God is going to pronounce judgment because of their wickedness, because of the hardness of their heart, because they double down in their iniquity. In fact, he's going to give them generations and an opportunity, but we're going to find that they continue to actively sin against him. Their judgment, by the way, would come about when Israel enters the Promised Land as led by Joshua after the Exodus from Egypt. And so we're going to look at that in probably several weeks from now. But it was Canaan who was cursed, not all of the descendants of Ham. But also we find Japheth. He is going to be the ancestor of all of those who are to the north and to the west of Israel. And then we find Shem. Now, Shem is really an interesting character because he is the ancestor of the sons of Eber. And we find this in Genesis 10:21. Eber is actually the origin of the word Hebrew. And so we're going to find that Shem is the one through whom the Hebrews come. And so the Messiah is going to come through Shem, through his genealogical line. So we continue here in our reading, and we see that there is going to be blessing that is pronounced. And Shem, by the way, it says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." And that is exactly how history would play out. But then we get to the 10th chapter, and there's a lot of sort of curiosity in this chapter. Some of the genealogies are developed, and we are introduced to some interesting characters along the lines. And one of those characters, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on him, but as far as people speculate, there's a character in the 10th chapter who is very interesting to biblical historians, to the curious Bible reader even, and that is an individual known as Nimrod. We are told that the sons of Ham were Cush, and I'm just going to skip down to verse 8. It says that now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. It says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And so we're going to find that he is an interesting figure in the development of Babel. Of course, our mind should go to the Tower of Babel, and then, of course, to the Babylonians. And so there is a lineage there, I believe, intentionally developed, where we're going to find that he is a very interesting, mighty character who has a lot of influence. And by the way, he is identified in several different mythologies and other works of antiquity from diverse cultures. And so he is described in a number of different cultures and civilizations. And so he's certainly a historical figure who is interesting. Now, there are those who try to project all sorts of things upon him and extra biblical accounts, including historians around the time of Jesus. There are going to be people who try to project all sorts of things on him. I want to say it's important sometimes that we pause the brakes and we ask, what do we know from history? What do we know from the biblical account? Let's not go outside of what we know to be true. But regardless, he is an interesting figure and worth commenting on as we're doing a brief overview of the book of Genesis. Now, when we come over to the 21st verse of this chapter, we're going to find another character. It says, also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, and the oldest brother, Japheth, children were born. And so it's going to identify those children. As I said, one of the outcomes here of Eber is that he is going to be the father of all those who are the Hebrews. With that, I'm going to skip down to the 11th chapter, and a very interesting narrative here that has led to some curiosity and speculation and some questions. Why did God do that? Sometimes we read through Scripture and we find ourselves asking, what was that all about? Why does God do something like that? But we know always that his ways are higher than our ways. He is far wiser, of course. But we come to the 11th chapter, and it says, now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Now, if you read through the 10th chapter and identifies different ethnicities and languages, then you come to the 11th chapter and it says that the whole earth used the same language and the same words, you might be very confused. But remember that in this time period, people lived for hundreds of years. There is an overlap. Also, it's important to remember that the 11th chapter is identifying what happens during or before most of their lifetimes. And so there is no contradiction here. Instead, it is just relaying what led to the development of these diverse cultures and languages. It says, it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone and they used tar for mortar. They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now, why did God do that? Why did he split them up? Isn't that a good thing that they have unity? People have been striving for world peace forever. We find this utopian image in so much literature and in movies, and this desire that we could all get along. You know, humanity could sit around this great campfire and sing Kumbaya. Wouldn't that be a great thing? No. The problem here is that God had told them to spread across the whole earth, to subdue it. He had told them to populate the earth. But they're acting in direct rebellion against God's command. And they are doing so because they are puffed up in pride. And so they're trying to build a tower to the heavens to declare how wonderful they are. This is not an indictment on just building a tall structure. It is human pride manifest in such a way as a people united to to oppose God. So what they're really united on is not these great human values of unity and getting along and loving one another. That is not the basis of their unity. They are united in one voice in hostility against God, and they are working together in active rebellion against Him. What an incredibly wicked generation we find in Genesis chapter 11. And we find that God's reaction to this is actually merciful. He could have destroyed them. He could have destroyed them another way, but instead he just disperses them. And in doing so, he actually fulfills his good purpose, his intent. I would contend that a plurality of ethnicities and languages was God's intent the entire time. And he desired for them to have diverse backgrounds and cultures. And so he wanted them to spread out from one another, but they refused to do so. So we find this narrative, and then in the 10th verse of the 11th chapter, we find another one of those divisions of the text where it tells us that these are the generations of. Remember that Genesis is neatly organized, and each time we find an interesting character, a significant historical figure who is described, and we find that there is a narrative that follows that. And in this verse, it says, "These are the records of the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and became the father of Arphaxad 2 years after the flood." Now, remember, who comes from the line of Shem? The Hebrews. And of course, because the Hebrews do, the Messiah does as well. It says, "And Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arphaxad, and he had other sons and daughters. Arphaxad lived 35 years and became the father of Shelah. And Arphaxad lived 403 years after he became the father of Shelah, and he had other sons and daughters. Shelah lived 30 years and became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived 403 years after he became the father of Eber, and he had other sons and daughters. Eber lived 34 years and became the father of Peleg." Do you know where we find the name Peleg, by the way, in the New Testament? We find him in Jesus' genealogy. So Peleg is a very interesting character. Now, we skip down to the 27th verse. I'm just skipping ahead. It says, "Now these are the records of the generations of Terah." And again, these are the generations of another division. "Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran became the father of Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." So we're going to find that Terah is going to move his family from south of Babylon to the northern region, north of what would be Syria, Damascus, those sort of locations, to a place called Haran. So they are in this area north of the Promised Land. That is where we find that Terah dies. Next, we find in the 12th chapter, a very interesting development. This is going to be very significant for us now and as we continue reading through the rest of the Bible. We're not just tracing genealogies for the sake of tracing genealogies. We're asking, how did human civilization come to be? What should we expect to find in human civilization in these diverse cultures? What sort of blessings, what sort of curses were pronounced on them? Why did God choose to pronounce a curse on Canaan, for instance? Why does God choose to bless Shem? And what would that blessing look like? Well, in the 12th chapter, we're going to find an interesting answer to that question of blessing. In the 12th chapter, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So the north of the promised land, and God is going to tell them to set out to the land of Canaan. And in the fifth verse, we find that that is exactly where they go. But what we found in the first three verses of the 12th chapter was what is described as the Abrahamic covenant. Now, God is going to perform a ceremony to usher in the Abrahamic covenant in the 15th chapter. I'm going to spend some time looking at that next week, the 15th, 17th chapters. We're going to unpack some details that correspond with this covenant. But there are a few things that I want to make sure that you do not miss today. The first is that God did not choose Abram on the basis of merit. There is nothing to indicate from God's selection of Abram that he was somehow uniquely deserving of being blessed. Abram did not work to receive God's favor. Instead, we find God's graciousness. We find his unmerited favor. We find that he makes a covenant with Abram. This is a binding agreement. A bonding agreement between God and man. God is the one who had to initiate this covenant. Abram was completely unable to initiate such a covenant with God. You can't pronounce a blessing on yourself. Blessings come from somebody greater than you. And by the way, we're going to look at that also next week when we talk about Melchizedek. And I'm really looking forward to that discussion. But Abram was told that from your relatives and from your father's house to the land I will show you, you're supposed to go from one place to another, and I'm going to show you where you're going to go. He doesn't even tell him outright at this point where he is going. He just tells him, go. What's Abram going to do with that? We're going to talk about that in just a minute. He says, and I will make you a great nation. Now, how is that possible? Remember that in the 30th verse of the last chapter, it tells us that Sarai was barren. She had no child. Abram is told that you're going to have a great nation. How? I don't have any children. So who could possibly come after me? How could a great nation be established? Abram has to be looking at his biological clock and saying, wow, time is ticking for myself, for Sarai. What is the likelihood we're going to be able to have children if at this point we have been unable to do so? But God is promising that which seems completely impossible, and along biological lines, very naturalistic explanations very well might have been. And he says, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who curse you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And this is the part I want to make sure you don't miss. And it says, and in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, that is a remarkable statement. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, this is a wonderful thing. He's saying that God's blessings are able to flow through generations, and that God is going to do something miraculous through his generations. One, that he's going to rise up generations after him. And two, that out of these generations, that all of the people of the world will be blessed. How have we been blessed by Abraham? Of course, that's where his name is going to be changed to. We've been blessed, of course, because as we've already looked today, the Messiah comes through the line of Shem, through Peleg, through Abram. We're going to find that God has a plan to bless the nations, to pronounce his good favor, his hope of everlasting life, of a relationship with the Father, to restore what we lost in Adam. We would find in the one who had come through the seed of Abraham, and be blessed and enjoy all the wonderful things that God has for those who would respond to him as Abram did. But how did Abram respond? Well, Abram responded in faith. God said go, but didn't tell him where to go. He told him that he would have children, but his wife was barren. He told him that through this barren woman, that through generations that did not exist, that all the nations would be blessed. And do you know what Abram did? He went. In verse 4, it says, so Abram went with the Lord, went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. He doesn't need all of the details. He just said, God has spoken, I will obey. God offered his covenant to me, and that is more than enough for me. Is that enough for you? There are so many things in life. And this week in our church, we're doing Vacation Bible School. We talked last night with the kids about the story of Jesus calming the storm. So I'm going a little bit into the New Testament here for a minute, into Mark 4. And as we talked about, I said, you know, there are times in life where we feel like the disciples were on the upper deck. And the storm is coming. We are overwhelmed with the sound and all of the stress of the storm, metaphorically speaking, more often than naturally speaking. And we're overwhelmed and distressed, and we're completely out of our elements. We're disoriented because we're in a unique situation, even though these disciples that have been on boats before and now they're afraid for their lives. And we don't see Jesus. We don't hear him. We wonder if he's even there, if he cares about us. Do you even care if we die? And we get to points like that. And in moments like that, we have to, in faith, trust that God is who his word says he is, that he is capable of doing everything that he says and has demonstrated himself to be able to do. And here in Genesis chapter 12, Abram has surely heard much about what God has done, of what he has promised to do. Abram is at this moment where he has a decision to make. Is he going to respond to the revelation that he has received, that God has revealed to him? Is he going to walk in that, or is he going to be disobedient, believing that he can create some utopia for himself as those who tried to build the Tower of Babel did? No. Abram simply went. Now, I'd like to tell you that as we continue through this narrative, that Abram is going to be unwavering in his faithfulness, that he's going to be a perfect human being. He never is going to sin. He's never going to stumble. He's never going to doubt. But that's not what we're going to find. We're going to find that Abram is a man much like us, often in his failures. But I wonder, are we men and women like Abram in our expression of faith, trusting when there is every reason from a natural perspective to doubt? Next week, we're going to look at what God did through Abram, through Sarai. We're going to look at a very interesting character in Melchizedek. I hope that you'll tune in. May God bless you.